Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You could use a shortwave radio with the schedule of English language broadcast, but it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from NHK Japan, France 24, Radio Havana Cuba, and Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. We will begin with NHK World Radio Japan. 97% of new vehicle sales in Norway are electric, with the goal of 100% to be reached soon. In the United States, tax credits for those purchasing electric vehicles have been stopped, leaving General Motors and other manufacturers cutting back on production. NHK Japan.
Now, electric vehicles have been promoted as an effective tool to reduce carbon emissions. In the shift to EVs, Norway is the clear front runner. The Scandinavian nation is close to its goal of ensuring that all new passenger cars sold are zero emission. But issues remain, even if the finish line is crossed. NHK World's Katja Jones reports.
Electric vehicles are clearly dominant on the streets and highways of Norway. In July, they accounted for 97% of new car sales, with 100% in sight. The focus on EVs to cut emissions stems from the unique nature of Norway's energy mix. The vast majority of the country's electricity is hydro-generated and emits very low levels of carbon. That means the transport sector, including automobiles, is responsible for a large proportion of greenhouse gas emissions, about a third by one estimate. Oslo and local governments have been driving the shift toward eco-friendly cars by introducing tax cuts and preferential rates on toll roads for EVs. Meanwhile, taxes have been raised for fossil fuel vehicles. EV charging is now available at more than 120 locations, while demand for gasoline is on the decline. For the customers whose cars are charging, there's a waiting space provided. While EVs are the standard for new car buyers, only about 30% of passenger cars driven in Norway now are electric. So, the shift to a low-emission future may take some more time. Katia Jones, NHK World.
General Motors says it will book a $1.6 billion charge in the 3 months that ended in September as it adjusts its electric vehicle strategy. The American auto giant said on Tuesday it expects EV sales to decline after the expiry of a tax credit of up to $7,500 for U.S. buyers at the end of September. The charges include adjustments to GM's EV production capacity and contract cancellation fees. GM said the Trump administration's moves to ease emissions regulations for gasoline-powered vehicles is also likely to affect EV adoption. GM is not the only automaker reassessing its EV strategy in the United States. Japanese automakers are cutting the range of fully electric models they produce in the country.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan on shortwave. They're heard at 10 p.m. at 15310 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp. All the times I announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. NHK may be easily found at most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. Next, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. A large percentage of international news this week was focused on the ceasefire in Gaza. I thought this piece from Germany covered most of the discussion points. Distribution of food and supplies is restricted to less than half of what was expected. Gazans are returning to almost complete ruins with water and electric sources destroyed. Estimated costs to rebuild are $70 billion and will take at least a decade. An interview with Andrew Gilmore, former United Nations Assistant Secretary General for Human Rights. He says that the scale of the destruction in Gaza is the worst anyone has ever seen. It was bombed more severely than the combinations of Berlin, London, Hamburg, and several other cities during World War II. He thinks Israel may impede removing 60 million tons of rubble and then may destroy any new construction that, as they have done in the West Bank. He doubts that there will be any accountability for the war crimes that have taken place in Palestine. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
Israeli media reports say that Israel is planning to reopen Gaza's key Rafah border crossing with Egypt, but one security source said that it could take days. Thousands of tons of food and medical supplies have been waiting to enter the territory as residents return to find their homes in ruins.
As a fragile truce appears to hold, people in Gaza are getting on with the basic business of survival, returning to the ruins that were once their homes and desperate to feed their families. After 2 years of war, the situation on the ground is dire. Food, water, fuel, and medicine are desperately needed. Despite calls for urgent and unhindered humanitarian relief in accordance with President Donald Trump's peace plan, aid is moving at a glacial pace. International groups say it must come faster to save lives. Border crossings, which serve as critical entry points for aid, remain heavily restricted. Israel says that's because Hamas has failed to return all the bodies of hostages it is holding as part of the U.S.-brokered ceasefire deal. Security concerns and logistical challenges have further slowed the process. Adding to the misery and frustration for hundreds of thousands of Gazans.
And while so far the Gaza ceasefire is holding, what happens next is less clear. U.S. President Donald Trump's 20-point peace plan is short of specifics for how Gaza will be rebuilt. What is certain is that winter is approaching, which means additional hardship for the territory's largely displaced population.
Gaza in ruins. A field of rubble, an estimated 60 million tons that used to be houses, hospitals, schools. Few homes remain, and the vast majority of Gazans are now unhoused refugees in their own territory, with winter on the way. The solution is not far off, according to U.S. President Donald Trump.
It's so beautiful to see a new and beautiful day is rising, and now the rebuilding begins. The rebuilding is maybe going to be the easiest part.
That may be optimistic. Rebuilding Gaza will be a monumental task, and there is no deal or agreement in place on how to do it. Clearing those millions of tons of rubble and dangerous munitions in areas that are in some cases still under Hamas control is the first challenge. Thousands of dead bodies are thought to be under collapsed buildings. Decomposing bodies can cause serious health risks, including cholera and tuberculosis. Emergency housing as the weather turns colder is another major challenge. With an estimated 90% of houses damaged or destroyed, many Gazans have nothing to return to and have been living in tents under catastrophic sanitary conditions. Long-term housing and infrastructure will take the longest to rebuild, potentially over a decade. Nearly 80% of Gaza's roads are damaged, and most of its hospitals and schools are in ruins. Hamas ran Gaza's infrastructure before the war, and its control of these institutions could be a sticking point. Trump's plan for Gaza includes a, quote, Trump economic development plan that would create a panel of international experts to create investment opportunities that could help pay for rebuilding. The UN says at least $70 billion will be needed. Financing the rebuilding is the greatest question mark of all. The money will have to come from somewhere, whether as a business investment or humanitarian funding. With long-term control of Gaza still up in the air and Hamas resisting surrendering its power, it may be a while before the question is answered.
We are joined by Andrew Gilmore. He is a former UN Assistant Secretary General for Human Rights. He spent over three decades working in some of the world's most challenging conflict zones, including the Middle East. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for your time this morning. Speaking of time, I mean, as we've been seeing there, the time pressure in Gaza is immense. Hundreds of thousands of displaced Palestinians urgently need new homes, hospitals, schools. How do you begin the process of rebuilding when you don't even know who will be in charge there in the future?
People who have spent a whole lifetime in conflict and in reconstruction have never seen anything like this. The scale of the systematic deliberate destruction, the vast number of munitions dropped on the small area of Gaza, which equals dropping on Berlin, London, Hamburg, and several other cities combined during the entire Second World War. How to deal with this, as pointed out, 60 million tons of rubble needs to be collected. So it's going to be vast. And as we saw yesterday, because as you can imagine, finding the remains of all the bodies of the hostages is hard. And there was a delay in finding the remains of some of them. And immediately the Israelis cut down the desperately needed trucks of aid going in now. So, I mean, there are a lot of trucks in there on the border waiting to go in. They've been waiting to go in for months to try and avert the famine that's going on. I don't know quite to what extent the Israelis are actually going to allow people in, are going to allow the equipment in to remove the rubble. And by the way, a lot of the rubble is not to be able to be removed by equipment, because inside that rubble, 70,000 bodies have been found already. That's the casualties figure that's mentioned. But underneath that rubble, there are going to be tens of thousands more. And of course, you can't just have the equipment picking heavy equipment picking that up. You're going to need individuals scrabbling through the rubble to try to find those remains. What we have seen in the West Bank, which is obviously not ruled by Hamas, where the EU have been trying to do various bits of development and have been building many structures, and they have been quite often destroyed by the Israelis, and then the EU rebuild them, and then the Israelis destroy them again. Of course, that means that the people who are going to need to put up the 60 billion, as has been estimated for Gaza, are going to need some form of assurances that the Israelis aren't going to go and destroy it again. And I don't know where we are on that. I mean, I am pretty convinced that the EU and the Gulf Arab states, who are going to be asked to pay large portions of this, are by no means convinced that they're going to have those assurances. So that is perhaps the most important factor. And it doesn't stop the vital aid that needs to go in, or the temporary housing that's going to be required. As you said, winter's coming up and we need to protect the people.
Trump has recently made it sound like the war is over and that the conflict is in the past. But where, and how do you see this aspect unfolding? Where is the time and space for accountability and addressing human rights violations?
There we have the great issue of what basically the rest of the world sees as the West's double standards, where we are quite rightly pushing strongly for accountability for war crimes that have taken place in Ukraine, carried out by the Russians. As we have seen in the last 2 years, there have been measures put forward, mainly by the International Criminal Court, but also by the International Court of Justice. And there we have found countries like the United States and Germany in particular doing basically all they can to undermine those processes. So there is going to be a lot of appetite for trying to find some accountability for what essentially people see as a very, very wide selection of war crimes, basically carrying out, and the whole range that is possible of war crimes, they've all essentially been committed in Gaza. There's going to be pressure for accountability, but there's going to be counter pressure, as I said, particularly in Washington and Berlin, to trying to find justice.
Former UN Assistant Secretary General for Human Rights, Andrew Gilmore, we very much appreciate it.
That interview and report was from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary, and most podcast sites. On to France 24. The United States military assassinated alleged drug smugglers in the Caribbean for the fifth time this week, while Trump said he was authorizing the CIA and considering airstrikes in Venezuela. A discussion on whether these are the first steps in regime change. France 24.
These tanks, parked on the outskirts of Caracas, were used in military exercises ordered by Venezuela's president. The country has been on edge in recent weeks. This Tuesday, the U.S. conducted a fifth strike on an alleged drug boat off the coast of Venezuela. Democratic lawmakers and U.N. experts have called the strikes in the Caribbean illegal. On Wednesday, Trump said he was now considering strikes on Venezuelan territory.
What's the next step in this war on cartels, and are you considering options, are you considering strikes on land?
Well, I don't want to tell you exactly, but we are certainly looking at land now because we've got the sea very well under control.
Trump also authorized the CIA to conduct covert operations in Venezuela. In response, the country's president, Nicolas Maduro, denounced the U.S. spy agency and historical coup d'etats he said it fomented in Latin America.
How long will the CIA keep staging coups? Latin America doesn't want them, doesn't need them, and rejects them.
The U.S. government accuses Nicolas Maduro of drug trafficking and is offering a $50 million bounty for information leading to his arrest.
Our Douglas Herbert's been keeping an eye on this story. He joins me now on the set. Doug, what are your thoughts here? Is this really about going after drug traffickers, as Donald Trump says, or is it perhaps about forcing regime change in Caracas, as critics allege?
Both. Donald Trump's official view, what he says is he is in, the United States is in an armed conflict with drug cartels that he and the Trump administration view as terrorist organizations. They call them non-state armed groups led by the biggest drug cartel leader of them all, the so-called leader of the Sun's drug cartel, Nicolas Maduro, the Venezuelan president. And they are basically staging an armed attack against the United States of America. That in conjunction with the fact that there's a giant gang in Venezuela that is opening up the prisons and letting them flood into the United States to commit crime. So if you listen to Donald Trump, his social media, his official statements, it's about fighting an armed conflict, essentially non-state soldiers, if you will, at war with the U.S., drug dealers, drug traffickers. But you don't have to do that deep a dive, Jeannie, to see that equally explicit or almost as explicit as you could get is a Trump administration strategy drawn up by the Secretary of State Marco Rubio and in conjunction with the CIA director John Ratcliffe, that this is, as we have been saying, a pressure campaign, an escalating pressure campaign to oust Nicolas Maduro from power, oust him from power. I.e., yes, regime change. This is one instance where Nicolas Maduro, who has not generally had the sympathy of the international community, when he denounces the Trump administration for aiming at nothing less than regime change, you could say, well, he has a point. Now, it's not because I'm sitting here saying it. It's because, like I said, the strategy has been explicit. In his own confirmation hearing a few months back for the CIA directorship, John Ratcliffe said that he envisioned a more aggressive, almost remodeled CIA. What does that mean? That means going after, and I'm quoting here, going places no one else can go. He's talking about the CIA under his leadership and doing things no one else can do. Fast forward to today's headline, Donald Trump authorizing the CIA to conduct covert operations. Presumably that is an authorization to either operations against Maduro unilaterally or against his government in general or a combination of both. Whatever the case, the question you ask me, is this regime change or is this going after drug traffickers? It is very much the end goal here. The ultimate goal is to oust him from power. It is regime change. And yes, Jeannie, you didn't ask me, but I will answer the question you didn't ask. It harkens back to a dark era, some thought an era that might have been past, of the CIA conducting coups, assassination attempts, and so on and so forth against people it doesn't like, not just in Latin America, but across the world.
Those reports were from France 24, which may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English, and most podcast sites. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this show like listeners in Nevada and Mendocino County did this week, PayPal contact information is available at my website, outfarpress.com, or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Your donations are essential for the weekly production and distribution of this show, which I supply freely to more than 100 radio stations around the world. And if you're listening on a public radio station, please support them as well. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. The awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize to Maria Machado of Venezuela was quite controversial since she supports U.S. intervention in her country. Hamas has rejected any role for Tony Blair in governing Gaza based on his history in Iraq and Afghanistan. Radio Havana, Cuba.
The network of intellectuals, artists, and social movements in defense of humanity has issued a statement strongly denouncing and condemning the awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize to Maria Corina Machado, which constitutes a cynical escalation within the hegemonic discourse and war effort of the United States. This maneuver is not naive. It seeks to deliberately instill in the collective imagination the narrative of an invasion of Venezuela disguised as a war for freedom. The text continues, "It is unacceptable and hypocritical for the Nobel Committee to present Maria Corina Machado as a unifying figure when her record demonstrates the opposite. She has consistently and openly acted against the Venezuelan people." The statement highlights that the honoree's actions include explicit calls to overthrow the legitimate governments of Hugo Chavez and Nicolas Maduro, active support for criminal sanctions that are suffocating her own homeland, and direct sponsorship of violent confrontation in the streets of Venezuela to force an unconstitutional exit from the legitimately elected government. The statement adds that Machado has appealed directly to Benjamin Netanyahu, the architect of the annihilation of Gaza and the genocide of the Palestinian people, and has signed a political agreement to help liberate, that should be read, colonize, Venezuela, while promising to reopen the Venezuelan embassy in Jerusalem, which openly aligns herself with the apartheid state internationally accused of genocide. This strategic alliance makes her complicit in the atrocities committed against the Palestinian people. Such a pattern of behavior, the text emphasizes, undoubtedly reveals fascist behavior, the ultimate goal of which has been and continues to be the total undermining of Venezuela's sovereignty in order to hand over with impunity this land of peace, home to the world's largest oil reserves, and to the insatiable imperialist vortex of the United States. Within the irrefutable arguments of the international work of intellectuals, artists, and social movements in defense of humanity, this says that the irrefutable arguments are, and is emphasized, that this appointment of the national hero, they're seeing this as Maria Corina, is yet another link in a strategy of death and domination, which seeks to impose in Venezuela a supposed transition to democracy, tailored to the United States, through the use of force, violence, and death. The strategically flagrant violation of the inalienable rights of the Venezuelan people to self-determination, and seeks to turn the Caribbean into a new and bloody theater of war. The statement by this important group of thought and action against all forms of domination includes the statement that this is a grave and shameful maneuver that does nothing more than seek to justify the death and destruction of an entire nation and offends rationality and dignity. The network of intellectuals, artists, and social movements in defense of humanity urgently calls on the peoples of the world, to all those who genuinely believe in and defend peace and sovereignty, to raise their voices in protest, forcefully and in unison. Let us not allow interference and war to be legitimized. Hamas has strongly rejected any role for former British Prime Minister Tony Blair in governing Gaza following the recently declared ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. Speaking to Sky News, senior Hamas officials said that the movement welcomed efforts by U.S. President Donald Trump to help end the two-year genocidal war, but warned that Blair would not be welcome in any role governing Gaza after the ceasefire. When it comes to Tony Blair, unfortunately, we Palestinians, Arabs, and Muslims, and maybe others around the world too, have bad memories of him. We still remember his role in killing and causing the deaths of thousands and even millions of innocent civilians in Afghanistan and Iraq. Tony Blair previously served as the official envoy for the Middle East Quartet, comprising the United States, Russia, the European Union, and the United Nations, from 2007 to 2015, through which he failed to achieve a breakthrough in the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. Trump's 20-point Gaza plan, recently revealed, includes the creation of a new international body, dubbed the Board of Peace, which would be tasked with overseeing an interim authority of technocrats to govern Gaza. According to the scheme, Trump himself would chair the board, and it would also include international figures, including Tony Blair, former British Prime Minister. The plan would establish a transitional authority in Gaza for up to 5 years, excluding both Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. Under the reported proposal, the authority would hold supreme political and legal authority over Gaza during an interim period. In a joint statement on Friday, Hamas, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the PFLP, reiterated that any decision on the future governance of Gaza is an internal Palestinian matter as the ceasefire in the territory takes effect. We renew our rejection to any foreign guardianship. We stress that the nature of the administration of the Gaza Strip and its institutions are an internal Palestinian matter to be determined by the national component of our people directly. On Monday, another senior Hamas political bureau member, Assam Ladran, wrote on the social media platform Telegram that including Blair in any ceasefire initiated is an ominous sign for the Palestinian people. Calling Blair the devil's brother, he added that instead of being considered for interim governorship of Gaza, he deserves to stand before international courts for his crimes, especially his role in the war on Iraq.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcasts. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Daylight Saving Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You do have to look harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online support. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 29th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.